Good morning. I'd like to thank everybody for coming. This morning is, I guess you call a special share. It's within our series that we try to analyze halachic personalities. Today's share is after Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, a memorable gadol, a forgotten posek. And I think that title even explains how the share came about. You know, earlier this year, we gave a share on Rav Scheinberg. We gave a share on Rav Nissen Karelitz, posek of Bnei Brak. And I wanted to give one other share about a personality. And I had a list of different gedolim poskim that I was thinking of. Rav Yaakov was not on the list. And in preparation, this week's share, it just hit me. Why don't I do one on Rav Yaakov? And I scratched my head, why didn't I think of that before? And I think that's so appropriate with the title, A Memorable Gadol. No one forgets Rav Yaakov, one of the leaders of the last generations here in America. But a forgotten posek, exactly the point. Rav Yaakov lived basically the same time period as Moshe Feinstein. They were nifter literally weeks apart. And Rav Moshe, everyone knows, was a world-renowned gadol posek that there wasn't someone like him in generations. And in some ways, Rav Yaakov, you know, was in the shadow of Rav Moshe. And you think of a posek in America, in the America that became what it is today, look, a lot is attributed to Rav Moshe, but Rav Yaakov, at the same time, was a posek, and we'll go through his biography, a Rav, and his psak also played a significant role. So I think, you know, that line, a forgotten posek, is definitely appropriate for Rav Yaakov. His son, one of his sons, of Shmuel Kamenetsky Shlita, Rosh Yeshiva in Philadelphia. So people know of him as the Rosh Yeshiva. About 10 years ago, started coming out these halachos for him, Kovitz halachos, and people also were scratching their heads, like, Rav Shmuel is a posek? Same thing. In Rav Shmuel's case, it might be even more so, because people just knew him as a Rosh Yeshiva. He never held a position as a Rav. The general world did not know that he was a posek. But these Kamenetskys, they have a lot up their sleeve. And therefore, I think it's appropriate for honoring and focusing when we learn about the Pesach in Halacha of different Gedolim poskim that Rav Yaakov, a memorable Gadol, but a forgotten posek. Also, I thought it was Hashgacha Pratis that I decided to do this year just the other day. And unfortunately, I read in the newspaper on Friday, Erev Shabbos, that one of my Rebbeim, actually, I guess my first Rebbe, my first grade Rebbe back in Yeshiva Torah's MS Kamenetz in Brooklyn, was a wonderful yid at Sadik named Binyamin Sugar. Just passed away this week, well into his 90s. He's teaching first grade cheder for, I think, over 50 years. Big tzaddik. People said he could have been one of the Laman Vovniks. And supposedly, the newspaper says that Rav Yaakov said, Yaakov Kamenetsky said, that if all I did in life was influence and help produce two Talmidim, one of them being this Rav Binyamin Sugar, then that's my ticket to Olam Haba. And this Talmud, I'm sure, is greeting Rav Yaakov, or was greeted by Rav Yaakov as he went up to Shemayim just this week. Rav Yaakov was an amazing person, and I'm giving the share here in Yeshiva Torah Chaim and Torah Emes, Rabbi Yaakov played a major, major role in the starting of this yeshiva. And obviously, Rabbi Henoch Leibowitz Zatzal was the driving force. He sent his Talmidim here. But I remember many times that the Tzion Sheit Balma would say over many stories, many insights they got from Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov literally pushed them and prodded them that they have to open the yeshiva over here in Miami. So personally, here in yeshiva, we owe a lot to Rabbi Yaakov. I give first a biography, a brief biography of Rabbi Yaakov, so we get to know the contents of this gadol, this posik, and then to branch off to a few different areas of his uniqueness as a rav, as a posik. So Rabbi Yaakov was born different century, 1891 in Europe. And what's interesting, his family was a family not necessarily of Rabbanim, though trace back generations you would find Rabbanim, but within the recent Kamenetsky family, they were businessmen, all about them, simple people. Yaakov was born in a little town, a little shtetl. When he was a young bacher, his parents sent him to yeshiva. He went off to the yeshiva in Minsk together with a young bacher named Reb Reuven Grozovsky and another young bacher named Aaron, none other than Reb Aaron Cutler. And actually, Reb Yaakov and Reb Aaron were of the same age. Reb Reuven was a little bit older. Reb Reuven was the one who had a positive hashpa and influence on Reb Yaakov together with Reb Aaron. And he got them to go to yeshiva, to come with him to the Slobodka yeshiva, which was their next stop after Minsk. In Slobodka, Reb Yaakov became a close, close Talmud of the Alter, and that relationship affected Reb Yaakov for the rest of his life. The Alter was known as a tremendous machanach, a great pikeach, and really a lot of those traits Reb Yaakov connected to very well, because he too was a tremendous pikeach and a great machanach. And he learned as a bacher in Slobodka, but continued as a younger man. He learned in the Kolel. In that Kolel, he was very close with, in fact, he considered himself a Talmud Chaver. He was friendly with, he wasn't so much older than him, but he looked up to him as an influence, also as a Rebbe, the young Reb David Leibowitz, who was the founder of the Chavetz Chaim Yeshivas. And Reb Yaakov and Reb David were tremendously, tremendously close. You look through, Reb Yaakov talks about Reb David a lot, and it had a tremendous impact. And this connection that Reb Yaakov had with Slobodka affected every aspect of his life. In fact, his own shidduch was set up by Reb Avram Gradinsky, Shem Yakum Domo, who was the mashgiach in Slobodka, who was killed in the Kovna ghetto during World War II. After Reb Yaakov left yeshiva, he was offered multiple positions. In fact, even at one point, this I didn't know until researching, he was really offered Reb Chaim Ozer, who was the Galo Hadar, the Rav in Vilna. Later in life, wasn't well and had to step away from his position. And really, he was looking into bringing Reb Yaakov in even before he took sick. And this was something that Reb Yaakov was debating, should he take the position in Vilna? But once Reb Chaim Ozer got sick, Reb Yaakov felt, oh my gosh, that's too much. I can't consider taking this position, because then people will view it that I'm stepping into Chaim Ozer's shoes. I'm not anybody to step into Chaim Ozer's shoes. And Yaakov never took that position in Vilna. His first position, took a position as a Rav, was in a little shtetl not far from Slobodka called Titsyatsvin. Hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. I remember years ago I had the schus to spend time with Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, Zatzal, one of Rav Yaakov's sons, Rav Shiva and Itri in Eretz Yisrael, and he himself is really the force behind all the Rav Yaakov biographies. He has a famous or infamous one, but a tremendous, tremendous person. And I remember him talking about this little shtetl which he was born. He was brought up in Tiatzvin when his father was Rav there. Like the smile, you know, anyone knows Kamenetsky's, their smiles light up the room. But when he talked about this little shtetl, who knew if they had running water there, back in Europe where his father was Rav, it was like the most idyllic place in the world. He was Rav there in the shtetl, which actually, before Rav Yaakov also had Chashav HaRabbanim there. And from that, he was looking to leave Europe. He started to see the winds of change and the challenges coming. And Rabbi Yaakov, Mazel took it. In fact, Rabbi Yaakov said, had he taken the position in Vilna or one of the other bigger cities, he felt he never would have been saved. He would have been there with his community and Pashtus would have perished with them. He took this little shtetl, Tiatzvin, and was able to move on from there. He was offered a position in Seattle, Washington. Seattle is a hotbed of a lot of stuff going on. But going back over 60, 70 years ago, it had a Jewish community there for a while. There was a big shul. I believe the Rav's name was Bikur Cholam Shul. The Rav's name was Wargalanter. And he took a sabbatical for a couple of years. And they brought in Rabbi Yaakov as his replacement. So Rabbi Yaakov was there in Seattle for a little bit. And then when Wargalanter came back, he himself helped set up Rabbi Yaakov with his next position, which is a Rav in Toronto. And Rabbi Yaakov went to Toronto and spent a few years over there. And thus, those are basically the areas, the communities, Tiatzvin in Europe, Seattle, Washington, the United States, in Toronto, Ontario. That's where, for quite a few years, Rabbi Yaakov served as a Rav, as a Posek, and also got very involved in all communal issues, setting up yeshivas, day schools, whatever they were needed in the community. And all this time, his friends back from Slobodka, specifically Rav Aaron, was trying to get Rabbi Yaakov, I see you as somebody who is needed for the world of chinuch, needed to guide Talmidim. And Rav Aaron was always trying to push Rabbi Yaakov to go into chinuch, leave Rabbanus and go into chinuch. We know Rabbanus and chinuch are really two totally separate positions. Rabbanus, for the most part, you're involved with Baal Batim and their families, but it's sort of from the top down. Versus chinuch, it's from the bottom up, starting with young, impressionable children and bachrim. And it's a totally different avenue of influence. And finally, in 1945, Rabbi Yaakov gave in to his friends, and he was offered a position as Rosh Hashiva in Tor V'Das, and he took it. He moved his family to New York, but then also his children were getting older, and Rabbi Yaakov became the Rosh Hashiva in Tor V'Das in 1945, and that lasted for the next 22 years. From 1945 to 1967, he was Rosh Hashiva in Tor V'Das. In fact, my wife's grandfather, Shmuel Neiman Zeratzak, was in Tor before he learned in Chavetz Chaim, learned in Yeshiva Tor V'Das, and he had a close kesher with Rabbi Yaakov. It seems one Talmud each day would bring Rabbi Yaakov breakfast from the lunchroom, and he would eat in his office. So Rabbi Nachman was the one to chop that opportunity. And with that, on a daily basis, he would ask him halachic shailos, because Rabbi Yaakov already was known as a Rav, as someone who knew halacha. And Rabbi Nachman took advantage of it. After 22 years in Torah Vadas, Rabbi Yaakov retired. And he was already 76 years old at the time. And he moved to this young, fledging community towards upstate New York called Muncie. A very, very small community. And Rabbi Yaakov decided that's a good place to retire, and he'll live there. Some say those 19 years he spent in Muncie were busier than any other years, any other period of his life. But there too, he did not function as a Rosh Yeshiva per se. He functioned as a Rav and a tremendous Baal Eitzah, and people came from all over to consult with him, get advice from him, get Pesach Halacha from him. So really, if you look through Rabbi Yaakov's life, he spent 22 years as a Rosh Yeshiva, but he really spent more than that. It was more than 22 years that he spent, close to 30 years, over 30 years, he spent as a Rav, as a Posek, as a Baal Eitzah, involved with people. And Rabbi Yaakov left, there's a Sefer Emes LeYaakov on Shulchan Aruch. That's one Sefer I drew a lot from this year. There's another Sefer, it's a biography, a slash collection from one of his Talmidim. It's Rabbi Jacobs from Muncie. The Jacobs family in Muncie was very close to Rabbi Yaakov. And he has a collection over there, which I found quite a few interesting halachas and stories. Multiple biographies in general of Rabbi Yaakov. There's Aryeh Zev Ginsberg, Sof HaZem Tzion, the Rav in the Five Towns, years ago produced a Sefer Shal Shivas Divrei Chachamim of interactions that he had with many Gedolim, including Rabbi Yaakov. And there's so much that you could find here and there about Rabbi Yaakov. And together, I hope to paint a picture this morning of Rabbi Yaakov's perspective in halacha and what made Rabbi Yaakov unique. And really, it's a schus if Rabbi Yaakov Taka was a forgotten posek to bring to life what Rabbi Yaakov brought to the table as who he was, a gadol, a rav, a posek. The first idea that I think stands out about Rabbi Yaakov was he was a tremendous Baal Havana. It wasn't just that he had a Bekiyas, he was a Rav, and he knew how to Paskin because he saw so many Svarim and just, rattled off what he saw. It was much greater than that. Rabbi Yaakov in Yeshiva grew to be such an Adam Gadol, such a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He had a very great depth of understanding. And that depth carried him with everything he did. But his Pesach Halacha, Memela, was a different Pesach Halacha. It wasn't the average, run-of-the-mill, yeah, this is what the rabbi says. Rabbi Yaakov had a tremendous depth to him. And I'll give you a few examples. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, Simin Kuf, Samach Tes. This is on your sheets. Halacha writes, you shouldn't put food in front of somebody who's not going to know, won't make a bracha. Yish makilim. Chaber brings, there are some that are mekel, nosim l'ani b'tzor tzedakah. They give it to an ani. So the Pashas are reading the Shulchan Aruch, it seems that if you know somebody that is unfortunately not going to make a bracha on the food that you give them, so then you shouldn't give it to them. Okay, maybe the person's going to die from hunger. It's nani, fine. But short of that, Shulchan Aruch seems to say you shouldn't give it to them. So someone asked Rabbi Yaakov, what about in terms of Kiruv? you're running a Kiruv organization, you're having an event, there's food there, come on. You see people are going to eat the food, but they're not going to make brachas. Maybe you should just do an event without food. So what should one do? Zakt Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov says 100% you can put food there. The Shulchan Aruch says, look, ideally you should have put food there. I'm not going to make brachas. He says, but no, we're dealing with somebody. Not only are you saving them when you're putting food in front of them, really what you're doing is saving them from eating tray food. If they're not eating your kosher food, if they're not from, they're going to eat tray food. So therefore, this person, you're weighing these two things, not making a bracha or eating tray food. I guess Rabbi Yaakov understood the Shulchan Aruch's case is one-dimensional. Look, this person is not medactic in brachos. No one says he doesn't eat tray food. So Shulchan Aruch says, don't give food to someone who's not going to make a bracha. But Rabbi Yaakov is saying, in the case of Kiruv, you're dealing with somebody who not only doesn't make brachas, but he also eats tray food. Now let's weigh those two things. Zakt Rabbi Yaakov, it's Yosir Chashiv Mashu Ochel Below Bracha. He writes, saving a person from not eating tray food is more chashiv than the Indian of not making a bracha on something. Rabbi Yaakov's Havana, he understood that these two things, when you weigh them, eating tray food is worse. And therefore, that you can't do. And you know what's better? Let him have the food, even though he won't make a bracha. Now Rabbi Yaakov understand it, and this we'll talk about later too. Rabbi Yaakov had tremendous bekias in hanhagas of customs of Gedolim. He knew that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter would do the same thing. He would allow his relative, who was not a God-fearing Jew, he would give him food, and he was okay with him eating without a bracha, as long as he's saving him from Macholas Asuras. By the way, it puts at the end. The reason Rabbi Yaakov did this was nothing to do because it's not good for Kiruv. If you're not going to give them food, you can't have bracha, so then, you know, then the person's not going to like them. Rabbi Yaakov held, no, you're doing the right thing. You got to do the right thing no matter what the costs are. So that's one example, I believe, of seeing Rabbi Yaakov's tremendous Havana. There's another case. This is brought in the Sefer Emes Yaakov, Simon Tov Kuf Chav Zayin, the Hilchos of Erev Tavshilin. We know that a person has to make an Erev Tavshilin in a situation where you have Shabbos after Yom Tov. And what happens if on Erev Yom Tov a person realizes he comes to shul, runs to shul, gets there, you know, right by Mincha, schwitzing away, and he realizes halfway through Shmona Esrei, oh no, I forgot to do an Erev Tavshilin. The Halacha Shulchan Aruch says that at least for one time in your life, you're allowed to rely on the Rav. The Rav makes an Erev Tavshilin, and he makes it for all the people in the town. And therefore, if you forgot, okay, you'll be covered by the Ravs. The guy realized he didn't do it. He wasn't sure. He technically could run back before Shkia and do it, but if he runs back home, he won't be able to make it back in time for Ma'ariv, and he won't be able to daven with the minyan. So he asked the Rav what to do, and the Rav told him to go back home. It seems everyone in shul saw the guy came in, heard the whole hack, and people were tumulting. Oi, what did the Rav say? Doesn't it go on? It's halacha, this. And everyone was jumping on the Rav. But Maisa, it seems the question was posed to Rabbi Yaakov, and Rabbi Yaakov says 100% like the Rav said. Because, once again, it's a Havana issue. The issue of relying on the Rav. Inachanami, Shulchan Aruch says that's something you could do, but that's a tremendous bidiyevet. If you're weighing that, relying on the Rav's Erev Tavshim versus you yourself doing it, even though it means you're missing Tefillah B'Tzibur, doing your own Erev Tavshilin takes precedence over davening Tefillah B'Tzibur. Again, it's a matter of Havana, not just, oh yeah, I knew this halacha. No, we have to know what's more important. Is saving someone from being treif more important than him not making a bracha? And also, you doing Erev Tavshilin the best way would also be more important than Tefillah B'Tzibur. There's an interesting halacha in Yeridea, Siman Resh Mem. There, in Emes Yaakov, it brings a whole discussion about first calling parents by their names. That gets into an issue of Shemos, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Rabbi Yaakov brings a tshuva from Rabbi Kiv Eger. Rabbi Kiv Eger asks, whether we say Ksiva Kedibur Dami. When you write something, it's as if you spoke it. Right? It comes up with many halachas. So, Frecht Rabbi Kiv Eger, if you say that Ksiva is Kedibur Dami, how could we ever have someone publish a siddur where it has the Shem Hashem Yud Hey Vav Hey? How could you let anyone publish a siddur like that on the tzad that Ksiva writing is Kedibur? So now they just wrote the name of Hashem. It's as if they just said the name of Hashem. So Frecht Rabbi Kiv Eger, you shouldn't be able to publish things. Every siddur should just have, you know, hay with a strechel to represent Hashem. How could you write, you know, Yud Hey Vav Hey in a siddur? Now you tell me, our art school doesn't do that, okay? But there are other siddurim that do. Definitely all the smarties siddurim do. Hey, you know, by many shuls, they have some artwork, different things. Tons. It says Hashem Hashem. It says, Zok Rabbi Yaakov, there's no problem with it. Rabbi Yaakov answers Rabbi Kiv Eger's kasha on, you know, an issue of the Shem Hashem. Rabbi Yaakov says that the idea that Ksiva is Kedibur, Ksiva is like Dibur, that's the Dibur that the Ksiva is like the actual way one pronounces it. When I read the word, let's say the sitter says Yud Hey Vav Hey, you're not reading that pronouncing Hashem's name. You're going to read that Ado Hashem. You're not going to read it saying Yud Hey Vav Hey. Thus, Rabbi Yaakov says, there's no problem. Ksiva could be Kedibur, but it's the Dibur, the way you pronounce it. Mamela, you could write the Shem Hashem. You could have your things, because it doesn't go by what it the etzim is. It goes by the kri, how you practically read it. This, another halacha, this I found in that Sefer Mechitzas Rabbeinu, and I put on the bottom of the sheet. Very, comes up a lot here in Florida, right? We have fruit trees in people's homes and outside their homes. But many fruit trees. You come to property and, you know, you want to do some building, you want to do things. Can you knock down a fruit tree? So everyone knows this is a halacha that one shouldn't. In fact, not just the halacha one shouldn't. They talk about the fact it's a sakana. That if one would knock down a tree, that Chas Hashem could bring horrible things. So Shivan Munsi purchased the plot, the land, but they knew there were trees there. They came to Rabbi Yaakov, are we allowed to cut down the trees? You want to build a building here? So Rabbi Yaakov said, and I looked it up, he based it on the Taz in Yeridea. Rabbi Yaakov says 100% one would be allowed to knock down that tree in order for building, based on this tas. Okay? So the yeshiva went, they hired a construction company, and they started, you know, ready for the building, so they knocked down the tree. The smallest one, in the process of knocking down the tree, the construction worker, Gentile person, was knocking down the tree, and somehow the tree hit him, and he got tremendously hurt by it, maybe even paralyzed. And the heads of the yeshiva came running to Rabbi Yaakov, tell him about it. Like, he said it's okay, but look, that's what kind of happened. Rabbi Yaakov didn't flinch. He was unfazed. He 100% felt this is the right psak to go and chop down a tree for the yeshiva based on a taz. Didn't flinch. The only thing he said, though, he started asking the heads, I hope you have insurance, you know, take care of this person. But was the psak wrong? Rabbi Yaakov's Havana, this is the taz. The taz says you're allowed to do this. The Farish, I have no question. When you're a Baal Havana, when you understand something so well, so then this is the emes, this is the truth. Teaching emes LeYaakov. Yaakov's Havana was so powerful. I'll leave you with one last story in this area, the depth of his psak, his Havana. You know, at a bris, commonly, you know, it's painful. And he'll hear a kid, the baby, the rachanim will scream, cry. Commonly what's done, you know, they stup him with some wine, some pacifier, you know, after the bris. So there they are, the bris and Mansi, and the baby's screaming, and they're about to recite the brachas and the kriya shem, the kid's screaming away. So the father goes and he's about to, like, put a pacifier in. And Rabbi Yaakov was up there, he was a sandik, he was getting the brachas, and he quietly turns to the father and says, no, don't do that. The father, what? The kid's crying, is it? Don't do it. Okay, listen to Rabbi Yaakov, the kid's screaming away the whole time during the brachas and kriya shev. Afterwards, Rabbi Yaakov explained to him, and this is on your sheets also. Rabbi Yaakov said, when a baby is crying in a bris, it's an eighth rachamim. The cries of a baby at that moment in time, it's a special time for people to daven and to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu what they need. How could you go and be memayed that by putting in a pacifier? Anyone else? But the poor baby. You putting in a pacifier, it's not going to make him feel better. Per se. Okay, you'll quiet him. It'll come out in the video clearer, the name. But Rabbi Yaakov, with his Havana, how could you take away from people the opportunity right now to shas the bris? I guess after it's finished, you can put in the pacifier. But it's still kriya shem, it's still brachos. This time they could continue to daven. Don't take away their chance, their opportunity to daven. Rabbi Yaakov was such a Baal Havana, he understood from what the halacha should be, from cutting down fruit trees to stifling or not stifling a baby's cries. That was one area where Rabbi Yaakov excelled. Another area, which I think is a famous area that is known about Rabbi Yaakov was a tremendously practical person. His head, he might have been a deep thinker and had tremendous havana, he was so practical, and that's such an amazing koach for a rav, and all the more so for a posek. Just to give two stories about this, really outside of psak, to show how practical Rabbi Yaakov was. A story that two gedolim were in a taxi. Even though I checked it up in the art school biography, they didn't say who Rabbi Yaakov was with, but I think it's okay to say it. Rabbi Yaakov was in a car, taxi, together with Rav Hutner, Shiva of Chaim Berlin. And they're going somewhere, and the taxi driver in New York got lost, didn't know how to go. Rabbi Yaakov's sitting in the back seat, he leans over to the front and starts telling him step by step how how to go. Rabbi Yaakov was an absolute bucky in directions. He studied the maps. He knew the whole subway system. If you ever got lost in New York, you know who you should have called? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. He knew everything. Meanwhile, Rav Huttner, the Rav was sitting in the back, felt this, the Bakovedik, you know, the Rosh Yeshiva, the guiding taxi driver. He was trying to, you know, get Rabbi Yaakov back down. Rosh Yeshiva, please, please, you know. Rabbi Yaakov, just a simple break. We're lost. We want to get there. I'll help you get there. I know how to do it. That was Rabbi Yaakov. I think I just saw this story. Never saw this before. Rabbi Yaakov's ability of understanding. There was a Talmud in the Slobodka Yeshiva who grew up in a secular background, went to university, and somehow he made his way to Slobodka. And they set him up, actually, with Rav David Leibowitz. He was learning with them. At one point, they got to a Gemara, perhaps it's Gemara in the beginning of Gittin, where they're talking about boundaries, aspects of Eretz Yisrael. And this Bacher starts challenging. Gemara's wrong. It's not true. I know the maps. You look at the maps. Not true. Rav David was not so comfortable with this guy's attack on Torah. He thinks he knows better because he learned in university. And Rav David just shunned this person. Wasn't comfortable dealing with him. Rabbi Yaakov, on the other hand, sat down with this guy, went through step by step the maps, his perspective versus the Gemara's perspective, and Rabbi Yaakov worked out, no, this fits with the maps. And he practically worked out for him that I can be miyashiv the question you have, I understand the question that you have, but this is how you work it out. Very, very practical person. It wasn't just maps. There's halachas in Hilchos Tefillah about davening on the road. And, right, the Shulchan Aruch goes through some Tzadi Dalad. Different times, different situations, a caravan, traveling by yourself, with others. When and if a person should stop to daven. And Rabbi Yaakov was asked multiple questions. Well, you're taking the Muncie bus from Muncie to Manhattan. What should you do? Lagabe davening? Should you stop? He says, you know, okay. If you're on a bus, other people, it's Man Tefillah, you're not going to make it. There's traffic today. Okay, so you daven on the bus. You sit down. What about even a car you're driving in? It's time for Mincha. And what should he do? So Rabbi Yaakov suggested that you shouldn't stop in these situations. Rather, you should keep on driving. And daven, while you're driving, while also driving, while you're sitting in the passenger seat, you should daven. And Rabbi Yaakov's Havana was, and this is his insight to people and to practical, if you're going to pull off the side of the road, everyone's waiting for you to daven, it's not going to be a comfortable Shmona Esrei. You're going to be davening there, you know everyone's waiting for you. That's getting rough, you know, like the shul is like waiting for you to finish your Shmona Esrei for them to start Chazaret Hashatz. You know, you start hearing the whistling from the back of the shul like this. It's not a comfortable time. You know, every Rav knows, okay, you got to speed up if they're waiting for you. Like, so Rabbi Yaakov understood, hey, if they're going to be waiting for you just so you daven outside and this, you're not going to daven a good Shmona Esrei. The best thing in that scenario would be for you to have to keep on driving in the passenger seat, so you daven. He says, furthermore, he says, sometimes it's a chashash, you know, people are traveling a big trip and time is pressing, and the 50 minutes we stopped to daven, took away from the GPS, just went up, you know, about 30 minutes, there's traffic over there, and the guy's going to try to drive faster, and this, Chas v'Shalom, going to be a sakana. So God says, relax. You know, during that time, we should, better to daven with kavana, with nachas, simply, you know, sitting in a car and then stopping at the side and making all these problems. There's Yaakov's asked Shailas, not sure exactly it's a scenario, but could you teach Hebrew to a guy? Actually, some of these secure organizations, a lot of times they do have Shailas that people who come and get interested in Yiddishkeit, their name might be Cohen, but unfortunately, it just means that their father was Jewish, but their mother was named O'Malley. And they're not Jewish. And Kiruv centers, unfortunately, in the world today, have many of these Shailas. But, so let's say one of the things this Kiruv organization is doing is not just teaching Torah, they're teaching basic Hebrew, Hebrew skills to help people. So, do I have to kick this person out? He's not Jewish. I'm teaching him Hebrew. So Rabbi Yaakov says, no, out the Isser, there's an Isser we know, I think Rabbi Sharfman gave a share about this years ago, teaching Torah to a non-Jew. There's an Isser to teach Torah to a non-Jew. Rabbi Yaakov understood that the Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh, that's not called teaching Torah. And that I could be taught to a non-Jew. You can teach him, right? This way, boy, he could say Shalom Aleichem, and you know, he'll have many workers in Jewish businesses all across New York that not only can speak Lashon HaKodesh, they can speak some good Yiddish too. It's funny when it comes out of some Mexican or Puerto Rican guy talking Yiddish, you know, better than many people I know here. But Rabbi Yaakov understood you still shouldn't do it. Because there's halacha in Shulchan Aruch that one shouldn't sell a pair of tzitzis to a guy. And sometimes I've seen this. I've seen some African Americans in East New York wearing tzitzis. I've seen it myself. But the halacha is you're not supposed to sell tzitzis to a guy. Because you know what? He's going to think he's Jewish because of it. So Rabbi Yaakov was very practical. He understood, hey, if you're going to teach Hebrew to a guy, that's also a means of him thinking that he's Jewish. So even though there's nothing wrong with it in terms of the Isser of Divrei Torah, but there is something wrong with it in terms of the Isser of him associating himself as Jewish because he speaks Hebrew. And one more halacha I'll share with you in terms of Rabbi Yaakov's understanding of the practical world we live in. You know, there's a famous minhag, this I found in Rabbi Zev Ginsburg's Sefer, Shalshuvas Divrei Chachamim. We know that there's a minhag that the Chassan and Kala don't speak to each other during, don't see each other during the week before the wedding. And it's done, to build up a certain excitement. I'll see you for the first time at the Badekin. Yeah. And it's a minhag, and Rabbi Yaakov in general said 100% people should follow the minhag. Rabbi Yaakov was also very practical and understood it's only a minhag. If there's a big tzarech that one could potentially do that, you know, could potentially see the kala. It's an important halacha for these days. You know, anyone who's engaged right now, this is not normal times. And there are many chassan and kalas that, like, up to the, you know, the day of the wedding, they don't know exactly where the wedding is going to be, when the wedding is going to be. There's a lot of stress, and to know that this halacha—it's not a halacha per se; it's a minhag. Chassan not seen a kala. There's, you know, something comes up, and it's, you know, they need to. There's a big tzarech. Look, in such a situation, you could ask a rav, but I'm sure there's room to be makel. But Rav Yaakov was asked, what about speaking? There are some people that don't really speak to the kala during the week before the wedding too. So this, Rabbi Yaakov thought, one shouldn't do. He thought, dafka not only was against his men not to speak, but he encouraged people to speak. Again, I would check this up, don't just quote this Rabbi Yaakov, just look into it. But what I saw, Rabbi Yaakov said that one shouldn't speak to the kala during the week before the wedding because naturally a girl is nervous and perhaps the best person to calm her and to save her from those nerves. Rabbi Yaakov understood people so well. He said, that's the chassan. And it's not a smart idea. You should allow, maybe scale back, but you should allow the chassid to speak to the kallah the week before the wedding. Now, that's the second area which I think Rabbi Yaakov excelled in. You see, his piskei halacha were not just was he a deep bal havana, but he also was such a practical person. His head might have been in the clouds, but his feet were clearly walking on this world. And the final area which I think Rabbi Yaakov just excelled is his knowledge of minhagim, of customs, of what went on in the Torah world, in the Jewish world, for generations and generations. And such a tremendous havana Rabbi Yaakov had in this. He had such tremendous knowledge. And he would... He was a tremendous Baal history. You know, anyone ever met his son, Rav Nosson Zatzal. Rav Nosson, he was a history professor. The way he tackled in his svarim, you know, the subject of history was a sugya in halacha. He would debate historical issues. He had such, Rav Nosson, I'm sure, got that element from Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov had a tremendous command of knowledge of what went on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years in the Jewish world. One example starts personally, Rabbi Yaakov, this I put in the sheets, was from that Sefer Mechitzas Rabbeinu, that the Ramah and Yeridaeus and Reish Samach talks about in Hilchos Mila, a sandik, and that a sandik should only serve as a sandik once per family. So if someone's a sandik for the oldest son, it should not be the same sandik for the second son. And the Gemara challenges this, and there are many people that are not makbid on this. The famous story about Rav Shach, how he did it for multiple people. And there are people that were makel. But Rabbi Yaakov refused. And Rabbi Yaakov would never accept to be sandik twice in the same family. And he says, you know why? I have a Kabbalah, I have a custom for my family. Rabbi Yaakov says he himself was born Chaf Adar Aleph. And his bris, there was a big snowstorm. And the person who was supposed to be sandik didn't arrive. But nevertheless, his grandfather was asked to be sandik. His grandfather refused because he already was sandik for Rabbi Yaakov's older brother. So Rabbi Yaakov was dead, said, this is a custom of my family. How could I do sandik twice? This is what my family did. Rabbi Yaakov talks about in the Sefer, Emes Yaakov, I saw Rav Nosson Kamenetsky talk about this topic too. Rabbi Sharfman gave a share about this years ago. Concept of a Hecha Kedusha, that some places, yeshivas, that for Mincha, before the individual Shmona Esrei, the Chazan starts Shmona Esrei and goes up to Kedusha, so it's really a Hecha Kedusha, it's really half of a Chazar Tzishah, it's half of what you call normal situation, Hecha Kedusha. And obviously it makes it go quicker. It's a full Chazar Sashat. And it's a funny minhag, like where does that come from? So Rabbi Yaakov understood things, and his historical perspective was, look, the whole Takana Chazar Sashat was for someone who doesn't understand. Once they started yeshivas were obviously for teaching students, and they had a great understanding in halacha. And Yaakov understood, you know why yeshivas never did a Hecha Kedusha? Because they understood that the takana wasn't made for them. And that's why by yeshiva, one would be allowed to daven with a Hecha Kedusha. A shul, that's what the takana was made for, Chazar Tzishah. They can't play games, can't do half a Chazar Tzishah, Hecha Kedusha. But the yeshiva could. I believe in the neighborhood here, North Miami Beach Kollel, originally when they started, look, there are a bunch of young light that came from Lakewood, and Lakewood they did, you know, the Hecha Kedusha. I think the story is that a few years into it, they asked Rabbi Yaakov's son, Shmuel Kamenetsky, and Shmuel Taina that my father said it's true for yeshiva, but yeshiva is dafka. Once you're a kollel unconnected to a yeshiva, you're your own entity in the community. Sorry, you have to go like any other shul. Who's coming to your minyan? People in the community. I'm sorry. There you have to do a full chazar sashas, and the kol here switched. This is all part of the great Kamenetsky understanding of customs of takanas of chazar sashas, and kedusha. Rabbi Yaakov was asked, this is in the footnotes, Nemes Yaakov, about a person getting life insurance. And they were questioning, could a person get it? It seems like there is a story that in Kelm, the Kelm yeshiva, the Musa yeshiva Kelm, so there they discourage their students from getting insurance. You know, I guess back in Europe they had an insurance that says fire insurance. They were discouraged. Kelm was against it. So they asked Rabbi Yaakov, are you allowed to get life insurance? So Rabbi Yaakov says 100% yes. Right thing to do. It's no different than investing, put away money for a chasna or for something else. 100% a person should get life insurance. What about Kelm? Yaakov knew every custom. Kelm? I'll tell you what's pshat in Kelm. The reason why in Kelm they didn't want the Talmidim to get fire insurance, because they knew one day a guy could pull a scam. He needs money. He knows he has a nice insurance policy. What do you do? You burn down the house. This is not a new American scam. These things, Kelm, the great Musa yeshiva, they're nervous of these things back in Europe. So that's why they said not to get insurance. Not something against insurance in general. It's against setting up a situation where it could be a scam. I guess they weren't close to someone knocking off somebody just so they could get their insurance policy. But that's another example of Rabbi Yaakov's understanding of historical significance in the Jewish world. Another area where Rabbi Yaakov was a tremendous, tremendous baki, a tremendous havana, is in the issue of names, naming children. And I gave share, I believe a couple of years ago, on names. I remember many, many hits. Everyone was going through that share. I think just from that share alone, it could be half a dozen people's names that they were going to give to their children changed. And a lot of the psukim, I believe I said there, you know, a lot came from Yaakov. Yaakov was a tremendous bucket of names. And I know my wife's grandfather, Shmuel Neiman Zatzal, had a lot of mesorahs and names that he got directly from Yaakov. What is good, what is a name he shouldn't have. One area, which is quite amazing, and this I heard Friedman telling me, you go through the Kamenetsky family, you would not find, again, for sure in the earlier generations, of Yaakov's own children, but I believe a lot of the next generations following with Rabbi Yaakov's psak, Rabbi Yaakov Nasara, Rabbi Yaakov would not give kids double names. No double names. You get one name. Even in fact, I remember my friend telling me, Kamenetsky in Chicago told him that he asked the Zeta, he wants a name after his wife's, you know, grandfather. He has two names. So Rabbi Yaakov said, okay, pick one. No two names. Rabbi Yaakov held, you should have one name. Where did Rabbi Yaakov get it from? Rabbi Yaakov's historical perspective. He says, you go through the Torah from the time of Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, go straight through Gemara, Mishnah Gemara, through the Rishonim. Rabbi Yaakov says, find me a double name. The Kamat did not exist. There were no double names. And Rabbi Yaakov said, that was the Masorah. The Masorah was just to give one name. Kol Shekein, if you want to name after two different people, that's Nishtahin, Nishtaher. You're not this one, you're not that one. You're not really naming after both. Rabbi Yaakov assumed that it came about, double names, because of Shalom Bayis, and they wanted to name for multiple people. But Rabbi Yaakov himself was strong, when possible, that one should only give one name to a child. And he also says, potentially, multiple names could come to halachic issues, on a get. You know, they have to know the exact names, and sometimes people don't use a name. I never knew you had a middle name. You know, so Rabbi Yaakov was very strong, and at least within his family, they kept it not to give two names. Another area where Rabbi Yaakov excelled and had a tremendous Masorah. This he quotes, it's actually in the Hakdama to the Sefer, Emes Yaakov and Shulchan Aruch. It brings a story that he heard firsthand from his dear friend, Talmud Chaver, considered himself a Talmud of Reb David Leibowitz, that Reb David learned with the Chafetz Chaim, his great uncle. He actually prepared with him and wrote with him the Mishnah Berurah, Hilchas Sukkah. And Rav David told over to Rav Yaakov the one time he remembers there was one with the Chafetz Chaim, and Chafetz Chaim wrote something over, and Rav David read it over and said, I think this might be able to be read two different ways, not so clear. Chafetz Chaim immediately erased it and rewrote it. And the Chafetz Chaim told him, Hashem Manu Lashon, it's so important to be medaktik in halacha when you write something, to be super clear, weigh every letter, and gave over this tremendous, tremendous diktuk in the way he wrote. And Rabbi Yaakov took this historical fact that his friend told him to the bank. And you look through the Sefer, the way that Rabbi Yaakov measures the words of the Chafetz Chaim. He said, the Chafetz Chaim wrote like a Rishon. I think Rabbi Yaakov Paskin said every word in the Mishnah Berurah has a din of Talmud Torah. Because somebody who writes like the Chafetz Chaim, he wrote medaktik every word like Rav David testified, then that you could rely on to be medayik and paskin lahalacha, and every word counts for a mitzvah. So I hope, with today's perspective on Rav Yaakov, these areas, the depth of psak that Rav Yaakov had, he understood halacha so well. He was an adam gadol ad ma'od, and the male of his psak was a deeper psak than just the average posek. He was this person who, no matter how deep he was, but very practical. And this is something that obviously affected the advice that he gave, but it was also something which did him well in giving psak over to people. Make sure it's a practical psak. And thirdly, Rabbi Yaakov was someone who had such a history of minhagim, of customs in the Torah world, in the yeshiva world, and his understanding of it, his great bakiyas in it. When you got a psak from Rabbi Yaakov, it wasn't just a dry psak. It was full of life, with stories. It's with backing of generations of rabbanim, gedolim, who he based his psak on. Not just the written word you'd find in the Sefer, but the historical treasure house which Rabbi Yaakov collected over a lifetime. And I hope with this portrayal this morning, Rabbi Yaakov isn't just that memorable gadol that we all know of. I remember as a kid growing up, I had a certain affinity. I read the gedolim books. You know, I share the same name, this one, of Rabbi Yaakov. And I always connected to Rabbi Yaakov. Who wouldn't? Such a beautiful smile. Shaychas Baruch Hashem, many times, his son Rav Shmuel lights up a room every time he walks in. And so his unsign. And I hope with this understanding, with this share, Rabbi Yaakov will not be a forgotten posek, but will be someone whose psak will be appreciated and treasured for generations and generations. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. I wish you a wonderful, wonderful week.